Track session number 23433, reel 6.
Jeff Kirk, reel 6.
Yeah, we used to go and sit up in this room because if you knew nothing about it, you had to go on a course, and the course was in a room where you sat around an oil stove, nice and warm. And but on the Wednesday, they used to have to go flaming, and the troop sergeant said to me, "Can you fire a gun?" I said, "No." I said, "I've got to go on a course." He said, "Well, you know how to do it." I said, "I don't know how to do it, but I'm on a course." So I said, "Well, you make it all right with the officer." I said, "No, can I fire?" So I used to charge up each tank in turn, I used to fire a couple of shots, so it's all come back. And I did all three tanks in the troop then, and that was it. Like, that was the easy bit as far as I was concerned. But I was never happy in the greys. And then they then converted to Comet tanks, see, which had the completely different gun on it. So I think that was I'm never sure it was 76 or 77, but it was a very high velocity gun, see, and we had to go away on a gun instructor's course. Well, there's about six of us, all Lance Jacks like. So anyway, we were sitting in the canteen one evening talking, and yeah, and they were all moaning and groaning. I said, "Well, what are we going to moan about?" I said, "Well, another one at six a day to you." They said, "What, you get paid for?" I said, true, I did. I got paid on day 21, I said. So I said, "If you want it to do the job for nothing, that's up to you." I said, "I'm not. Don't want to pay me," I said, "I don't want to do the job." And that's as simple as that, like, you know. So I think, but the only thing I can say about the graves, I did learn how to ride a horse there. Because they were a cavalry regiment, see, and they used to say, "Oh, give us back our horses." Like, well, when we went to Lunenburg, they had a proper German riding school there, a massive great enclosure with mirrors about 20 feet square and that, right? If you said you were going riding, there was no argument about it, you just went down a riding. And I always remember I was going down there one day and an adjutant was coming up and said, "Oh, see the groom, tell him you've got to take my horse out. So I got down there, I said, "When you see the adjutant, tell him I took it out, because I'm not taking it out." I said, "Supposing it by over a footlock or something, and I don't get it out." I said, "My life would be worth living." Hey? But we did think, they said they introduced this riding school, see? So anyway, I looked round. Now, I always look in a horse's eye. If I like the look of a horse's eye, so I picked this horse, right? See? And that was it. So we go around, and when you learn, you have cross stirrups. You don't use your stirrups, you cross your stirrups and you fold your arms. See, and you go round and round in this riding school, and then they decided you've got to jump this 5-bar gate, see? So, okay, we go round, and then this horse kept throwing this bloke, see? And this corporal said, "You take that horse." I said, "No, I'm quite happy." He said, "You were better rider than him, you take it," see? So I took it. So then we jumped this 5-bar gate, right? Anyway, he comes up to it, and up his back legs, and I'm over the gate on my own, right? He doesn't go over there. And I'm looking up, and so the corporal said, "Have another go." So I had another go. Is that the same thing? He said, "Have another go." I said, "No, I've had enough of it." He said, "I promise you, you'll get over this time." So next time, the third time, he came round and he whacked this horse, and the horse nearly left me behind, see? But that horse was called Sampton. Now, he's a throw out from the Hanover horse, because he had a Hanover horse, what do you call it, you know, not braised, burnt in his side, like, you know, branded in his side of the house, but it's got a big cross across it, see, that's right. Now, you could put his head round to your left boot, and he'd still go out in the right. The only way you could handle him was, you used to take him out, and there was three, like, telegraph poles, because the paddock there, where he did his job, was like a battlefield. The trenches with logs and barbed wire and everything around there, but there was three telegraph poles, see, and they were doing figure eight and exercising around there. We used to take him round this until you could feel him boiling inside, right? And then there was a long grass track went up, and you put him at it, see, and away you go, you get the best ride, everything, then he wanted to stop. That's when you gave him the whip. He gave him the whip, then brought him back, and he was good as gold. And I always remember one day I was jumping 5'6" with him, see. Now Terry Shaw, he was Sergeant Major, he'd been a rough rider when the Greys were cavalry, see? Of course, didn't know where a horse could do that. I said, oh. Anyway, he said, let me have a go. I said, here he is then. So I went in the stable, see? About 20 minutes later, he comes in, a horse, what colour your wallpaper was, and he hadn't been able to jump. I said, I thought you were supposed to be a rough rider. He said, you never get the horse to go. I said, you saw me go over it. I said, what are you going to do, Samson, then? Come on. Well, we went straight over. But, you know, if you didn't take him and give him his drill first thing, he'd have you off. And if you tried to mount him in the stables, he'd jump up and bang your head on the thing, yeah. That's one good thing about the guys. I did learn that. That's where I broke my leg, like I was when I was playing in the 4th Army Brigade trials, it was like. And I went to the 21st British General Hospital. I had 2 months in there, and I came home on the hospital ship Atlantis. Came into Southampton docks. The Queen Mary was in there at the time. And then I went in the hospital train up to Lincoln Military Hospital. I was up there for about a month, right? And then they sent me to a hospital at Ashford in Middlesex, right? Which was near home, right? I had another couple of months in there.
When was that? What year?
That was 47. Beginning to 46, I broke my leg, like 46, 47. I got the hint marked in May, eventually, 47. Mm. Yeah, 47, that's right, yeah. Because I couldn't get them, they wouldn't demob me until I was fit. See? That's why I told you I was doing all the exercise, and that is electrical treatment to try and get fit, like, because you can't get them up done fit, see, because they'd have to get your pension. See? Well, they said to me when I came out, oh, we'll get discharging under the long-term scheme. If anything goes wrong with your leg, you come back in the army on full pay. I thought, no bother, see? But what I didn't know until about 5 years ago, I was talking to a fella from Blesma, that the long-term scheme only lasted the 56 days of your leave. I thought it lasted forever, right? But if I'd known it was only going to last the 50, I wouldn't have come out. I said, no, I'll stay in until my leg's right. I went there. I thought, long-term scheme, fair enough, you know, what have I got to worry about? What else would you like to talk about? Right, the events of March 1st, Ian's sheriff, one of the officers, when we were away in Holland, asked me what happened to Lieutenant Bottomley on March the 1st. What actually happened was, it was almost a two-tank attack, really. There was another tank coming, but he had to trail along the back because he could only get second gear. As we were going in, Captain Carroll kept phoning, calling on the radio for the Guards Armour Division supposed to be porting in. And all he could get from him was, "Be with you in figures one, be with you in figures one." This went on for about 10 minutes, and he said, in the end, he said, "What do you mean? 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 day, or a bloody week?" So, anyway, after the time, he said, "We've got to go in." Well, as we were going in, I was gunner at the tank, and I was looking out the telescope, and as we were going down the road, there was a leading infantryman was laying, well, I presume it was a leading infantryman, laying in the doorway, waving his up and down as though slowed down. So I said on the mic, a leading infantryman on the right. Well, Bob Cheney, our usual driver, he started slewing the tank across there. Captain Carroll, who'd only come on the tank for that day because Captain Barber got in for Tiger, I think it was, and he was due to go on leave the following day, and he put some dolls in the boot when he got on. He said, "Nothing to do with us, driver, carry on." Well, the tank that was in front of us did about 20, 30 yards, and bang, up it went in smoke. So the crew, by sheer luck, all got out, and then the Germans started machine gunning. So Captain Carroll said to Bob Cheney, "Pull alongside," and he told Jack Anywell, he was our co-driver at the time, to get out and put them in, see. So he opened the pannier door and he shoved them. Bottomley, I think it was Ted Denman, was the driver on the tank. Lieutenant Bottomley and Ted Denman, they put him on the toolbox at the back of our tank. Now there was no more room, but the only way you can get from the front compartment into the turret is by the gunner's feet, because on the right hand side is where the ammunition bin. So I had to get off my seat, and I dragged George Steele, who was the wireless operator in that tank, dragged him in, put him down out of the seat. Then Chris Bright was the next one. I couldn't quite reach him, so I had to get off my seat. I climbed underneath my seat, it was only like a mushroom stool, and I just got Chris Bright and my arms when we got here. And Captain Carroll fell on top of me, and he got underneath the seat. And well, the day before, or that morning, my mother had sent me 20 churchmen, and a packet must have fallen out. And Captain Carroll, there was about 2 inches of blood on the turret, right? And Captain Carroll, there was a packet of fags floating about in this thing, right? And I got Chris Bright in my arms. Captain Carroll had fallen and trapped me in there, because he'd fallen and twisted underneath the seat, and I couldn't get any pushers to get up. Well, then Bob Chaney started shouting, "I'm not getting any orders, I'm not getting any orders." I said, "Bob, you're not going to get orders. Get back as best you can." Now, how he got back, I don't know. Now, I remember when we first got here, it went all absolute quiet. Like, and while I was lying there, I could see a round hole going to appear in a turret wall. A bullet was going, or something was going to come through there. It was going to come straight down there. It was going to turn 90 degrees and straight in my back. Now, I laid there anticipating, and nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, I was floating above the tank, and I was looking down in the turret, and there was all this confusion going on, and I couldn't understand it.
Do you mean that you imagined you were floating?
Yeah, yeah.
You left your body?
Left my body. I was floating up, looking at all this chaos in the turret. Like, it was just, I could still remember that. Like, you know, don't ask me why, like, you know. And then Bob Steeney, I suppose, brought me the sound, because he started shouting, "I'm not getting any orders." I said, "Bob, you're not going to get any orders. Get back as best you can."
Did you explain that Carroll was dead?
Well, he had his head blown off, you know.
But did Bob Chaney know that?
No. I just said he was dead. But, well, I didn't even know his head had been blown off myself, because I was at full strength, see, with Chris Bright in my arm. He's fallen on top of me, and, like, the seat is on a round thing on the tube, see, and as he fell, he got underneath there, so there was no room for me to lift him up to get out. And on the right-hand side, right in the centre, is a box of 10 Bren Gun magazines. Well, there's taped down the thing, so there's a post on one side. I couldn't get out either side, right? And I couldn't get up. I was trapped in there. And Bob Chaney, you know, he started to get back. But when we got back, now they must have got all the rest on me out, and I couldn't get out. And Yossel Franklin on another tank, because I don't know whether they had some fault or something, but they hadn't gone into action, and he jumped in and released box of 10 Bren Gun mags and got me out of it. Right. Then I went, then, right, then went, oh, that's what I got on Yossel Franklin's tank, and I thought, well, I better let them back at the headquarters know what's going on. And, well, that's right, it's Barbara Reeling. And I tried to explain it to them. They, all I got from them was message not understood, message not understood. And I remember taking the headsets off, hurling up the 19 set and saying, the buggers don't want to understand. Well, then I went and tried. There was a mortar platoon there, you know, dug in. I asked them where the headquarters were, and they just looked at me. I goes, "Oh, look, a ghastly mess." Well, I was covering my head to foot in blood, see. Now, Bob said, "Come on, we've got to get him out." When you saw Carroll, well, he got no head. All there was three neck bones just sticking out of his collar. His head had completely disintegrated, you know, all been blown to bits. Because a bazooka is only purely a blast weapon, right? And it had blasted the blood everywhere, you know, between the magazine boxes and everything. And I'd got a head full of shrapnel, and, well, as a matter of fact, I think now I've got bits of bone coming out of the back, well, I don't know. My boys think they're stone, but they're hiding their bits of bone off Carroll's head. Because even when they cleared the tank out, they found his cap badge, and that got holes blasted through it. Well, then Bob said, "Come on, we've got to get Carroll out." So we put the harness on. We have a special harness with long slings to dragging the dead out. And put it on. Well, Captain Carroll, when he got in, he used to squeeze his way in because he was a big bloke, see, and we couldn't pull him up through the cupola. We'd get him up to it, and we got him nearly up to the cupola, and this guard's colonel came up in a jeep. He said, "Where's your son, Ray?" I said, "He's in the turret." He said, "Tell him to come out here to me." I said, "He won't." "Well," I said, "for two reasons. A, he's dead, and B," I said, I'm not allowed to issue orders to an officer." He said, "Right, stay here," he said, "you're under open arrest for desertion at the front." So anyway, but just then, Dan Duffy, our major, arrived, and we told him what had happened. He said, "Oh, ignore that." He said, "Go back, get the fitters to take the cupola off and get him out." So he went back and took the fitters, took the cupola off. We got Carol out, right, and laid him on the top of the tracks, and that, in fact, with a blanket over on his, I think he was on a stretcher when I last saw him. And I always remember one knee was sort of bent up in the air, like, with a blanket over the top of him. And then I believe it was Reg Webb, one of the soldiers, that gave me a drink of whiskey. And then I got taken back to the MO light, and he looked at my head and he said, "I can't do anything with you." He said, "You don't want a doctor." He said, "You want a bloody great magnet," because my head was filled with bits of shrapnel. And then my ears, he plugged my ears up with Vaseline and cotton wool and gave me a chit to put in my pay book. And he said, the chit said, "Oh, to be kept away from all loud noises." Well, then I went back to Echelon then, and old Paddy Scullin, the one favour we did, he went round and got a blanket for me, like, you know, to sleep. We slept down in the cellar that night. And then the following day they came up and they gave me a new tank suit because mine was all saturated in blood. And then I wasn't on the tanks then until that March the 1st, for about another month then, because of my ears, right? Then one day, I think they just crossed the Rhine, and Stan Hartfield, a mate of mine, he got out of the tank and had half his foot blown off with the mortars. Well, we went up to refuel the tanks, right, because Paddy said, "Well, you can plug, your ears are plugged up, you can go up there," right? And Sergeant Webb said to me, "You're a gunner, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, kit aboard and go aboard that tank." I was just putting my kit aboard and Dan Duffy arrived. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going gun on that tank." So I said, "Have you seen the MO?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you don't go on any tanks that have seen the MO." So by this time I was fed up being in the echelon. So I then went and saw the MO. He said, "Well, if you want to go back on the tanks, you go back on the tanks." So I went back on the tanks. Well, Johnny Holmes, he wasn't too pleased about it. He said to me, "I'm not having you on my tank." He said, "You're not coming on my tank." So he got his ground sheet, put it, all his kit on it, said, "I'm not going on there." And he went off and saw Captain Barber. He said, "I'll go and see Barber about this." He was our tank commander, Captain Barber. And anyway, next thing I know, Johnny Holmes is putting all his gear back on again, under the tank. So I said to Bob Chaney, "Driver, what happened?" "Oh," he said, "Holmes, I don't care what tank you go on." He said, "But I'm having Kirk on my tank." I said, "So Johnny Holmes and me carried on the same tank." Then we went back across the Rhine again at Wiesch. But this time they built a Bailey Bridge, you know, well, a floating bridge, I think it was, across there. We then came back, and I drove the tank all the way from, when we came across the river, all the way from there back to Arnhem. Well, just before the bridge, they put a Bailey Bridge, floating bridge across at Arnhem, and Bob Chaney took over, drove it across there, and then we did an attack up to, I think, Oosterbeek. That where the airborne landed, because you could still see, we went in some of the houses and there were still, you know, buckets of blood and bandages, you know, in the houses, right? And all the slit trenches were still there. The one good find we did have, there was one slit trench with a long slit trench tip around the house, and there was about five mugs on there. Well, that's one thing and a soldier can't manage without his mug. So we grabbed the five mugs, like, so we thought we were in easy street.
Could you just go back to the moment when Tom Carroll, that fateful moment, how did it affect you?
How did it affect me?
I mean, what state were you in?
Well, I'd say, first of all, I was trapped. Like, I wasn't in any state. Like, I didn't know really know what had happened. I was about, like, I'd been knocked unconscious temporarily. I didn't know what had happened. And then, as I say, I was, all of a sudden I had a vision, I was floating up in the air, right, looking down the chaos. Then I was in the thing and everything went dead quiet. And then I saw this hole in the turret wall, and the shot was going to come straight away down in my back, and I just laid there and I couldn't understand why it didn't come. Then Bob Chaney started shouting. There was one instance when we got back and the ambulance had taken all the wounded blokes away. a cent overload of moaning minis. Now, I dived under the tank, and I think if anybody tried to stop me, I would have killed them at the time, right? You know, there's no doubt about that. They would, no way was I going to be stopped then. Then somebody got me into one of the tanks, and I think I smoked about 10 cigarettes in 10 minutes, like, you know. Then I tried to find, you know, somebody to tell something wrong, and then this colonel arrived. Well, Bob Cheney said, let's get him out, right? So we put the harness on him and started trying to get him out, and this colonel arrived and put us under open arrest. So that was the end of that. I think what it was, the reason he put us under open arrest was because they were trying to cover up for their non-appearance at the action, that they were making excuses for it. The sequel of this is, 4 years ago, I had a letter addressed to Andrew Wilson. Would I, you know, and it said, "Will you forward this to Andrew Wilson?" Well, Andrew Wilson was a captain. He was also a military correspondent for the Observer. He went out to Russia as well, and I put it in another envelope and sent it off. His press is 100 Rue de la Franklin, Brussels, I think a press office it is, so I sent it out to him. Well, then he phoned me up one day. He said, "Oh," he said, "I've got your letter, thanks for sending your letter." He said, "I put the fellow who was in Canada, in actual fact, Colvin his name was, I put him in touch with Alec Thompson." I said, "Well, Alec Thompson don't know much about it, because," I said, "he was in a tank about half a mile behind the line trying to come along, and they only get second gear." So I said, "I know all about it." So Andrew must have told him, and then it was Mothering Sunday. The telephone goes, we're just going out for Mothering Sunday dinner. The telephone goes, and the fella from Canada phones me up. And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I can't stop and talk to you now." I said, "Because we're just off to dinner." He said, "Well, when will you be back?" I said, "About 4 hours." Well, because we were out 5 hours, and I said to Molly, "Oh, well, it's too late now." But at 9 o'clock that night, he phoned me up, and we had a chat for about half an hour. Apparently, his father was second IC of the Lincolns, who we were supporting in. And when I mentioned about being put under open arrest for desertion in the front, "Oh no," he said, "you weren't going to be charged with desertion in the front. You were going to be charged with motoring out of action without permission." So, that's it, and I'm still here today.
When you got onto the radio to warn the other tanks, how were you
going? I think I was incoherent. That, I'm certain of that, you know. And when they were saying message understood, I see, we used to have a code name, "One of my babies is missing," or, you know, that. And I think I was a bit too Larry, you know, halfway round the bend, like. Because that's then, just after that, you know, when I'd done it, the mortars came down, that's when I dived under the tank. And I say, I think, I'm pretty certain I would have killed anybody but tried to stop me, like, you know, I was determined to get under the tank. But then somebody, I don't know, called me, and I got in another tank, and they gave me a cigarette, and I must have smoked about 10 cigarettes in about 10 minutes, like, you know. That's when Bob Cheney said, "Come on, we've got to get him out," like, you know, and then we got him out.
But that must have been terrible for him.
I say this, it still affects me, like, even today, like, but I suppose it's more or less what you expected at the time, like, because, you know, death and violence was around you all day and every day, you know. It's one of those accepted things, like, you know, the old saying, "There but for the grace of God, go on," and that's what it was like all the time, like. I mean, we used to lay down at night and say, "Thank the Lord I survived the day," and get up in the morning and say, "Thank the Lord I survived the night." And you literally lived, you know, half a day at a time, like, you know, and that's it.
You had a spell, is it true, soon after of not sleep? You had a went through a spell of not sleeping well. Would you like to talk about that? No, but just soon after.
Oh, I couldn't go to sleep, you know. Every time I shut my eyes, all I could see were these three neck bones. When we were tore him up, you're looking down on his neck, and there was just these three neck bones sticking out of his collar, like. Because even when they found his cat badge, there was holes blasted in it. You know, the pressure... See, the bazooka is purely a pressure wave. There's no missile comes through. All it does is it's got a cone, reverse cone. Now it's filled with baryton. It takes the line of most resistance, which is on top of the cone. That's why it has to stand off 3 inches at least, like to build up the pressure waves, and it literally burns a hole through the thing. It doesn't make a hole much bigger than about an inch and a half in diameter, and so it's been burnt through with the oxygen settling welder. But of course, all those thousands of little bit of shrapnel are just shot through the tank like it's about a shower of stones coming at you, and that just blasted his head a bit, because if you took a machine gun box out of a rack, you'll find these blood stains all down the sides of it, like so.
Who would have cleared up?
Jim Harding actually did the clearing up, because that's when I know that he said when he found that Carol's cat badge, it had got holes in it. But Jim Harding was a bit upset about it, like, because he'd just come back from leave, his first day back from leave, see? Well, of course, he hadn't got back onto his tank. Because in a tank, that is your family. This is what held you together. The worst punishment you could do to a tank man is to take him off his tank, because you've taken his home away from him. You know, it was the friendship and the comradeship in that tank, you know, that binded you together, like. And it's nothing you'll ever separate. And I think because we were all tank men, this is why we all had the same feeling. We all knew what has gone on in everybody's mind. And I told you about Les Worthy, didn't I, about, you know, the therapy that when we took him out there, and that was what, 50 odd years later on, right? When he wouldn't even answer the telephone. He wouldn't even allow us his telephone number to be published. And now, having been out there with us, see, he came out there with us, but of course he didn't have to explain anything to us, because we knew what it was all about. And he just said what happened to him. See, what actually happened was, their tank went over 8-inch shells they buried as mines. It blew the tank up, and it blew the turret clear out the top of the tank. Well, it killed the other two, and smashed both his legs up, see? And then he was in Ireland, and got awarded the American Bronze Star. You know, there was about 12 of them got the Bronze Star, and Lieutenant Ward, he got the Silver Star. Like, now the Silver Star and his medals are now in the Fort Montgomery Museum in Brest, or just outside Brest, like, because that's the reason they were there. Because the Yanks didn't have any flamethrowers. Now they couldn't take these old Napoleonic forts, because the walls were about 35 feet thick. The moats were dry moats, but you could go underneath and you could fire in from the other side. So when the infantry came over the thing, they were being shot in the back. So they called up from B Squadron, the 141 IOC, the buffs went down there, like, with the Americans, planned all the operation, and went in. And as they were going in, there was just one troop going in, Lieutenant Wall was leading, right? And the next tank went up on one of these mines, right? And so the others couldn't get through, but he carried on flaming 200 yards, right? And everybody was surrendering, right? And the infantry, you know, had been trained to follow up, right, the thing, and they followed right up. The engineers could then put explosive charge underneath the wall and blew a hole into the wall, like, you know. And but on the way back, his tank went down, and well, I think it was a cesspit or something, like, you know. But he got out with the brain gun, like, and started shooting back at the Germans, and then they gave up, and he got awarded an American Silver Star for it, which is now in displayed in Fort Montgomery Museum, along with him. But at Fort Montgomery, they've got a flamethrower tank, and the naval engineers there have built a dummy trailer. So there is a sort of a trailer. See, we tried to get a trailer from the Bovington Museum. They wouldn't let us have it. You know, listen, no. Because they got the tank actually came from New Haven Museum. See? And the French paid for it to go out there, like, you know. We go out there. Well, Charles Gascoigne, he was a big lawyer. You know, and he used to organise everything out there, like. When you went out to Brest, you didn't have a minute to spare. In fact, I remember the first time I went there, we were sitting down at breakfast. Come on, the car's already waiting for you, like, you know, and you had a minute to breakfast. And away you went all day long, like. In fact, the worst trip we went, we met the 29th American infantry div down there, and this colonel, you know, rabbit, aren't you, never heard anything like it. The French had say it, all in French, American officers say it, and then this colonel come along and say exactly the same thing again, and this went on every place we went to. And I always remember on the last place we didn't want to go in, like, you know, and Charles Gascoigne came out and called us in because we had a stand and everything with us thing. Said, you've got to come in. So we went in. Afterwards we had a drink and came out, and I'm sitting on the steps, and one of the Yanks said to me, that guy's got diarrhea of the mouth, he said. I said, you're telling me? I said, he's had it all day. And that, you know, but you know, as I say, we get on well with the Yanks. You see, to me, somewhere, I feel sorry for the Yanks, you know, the ordinary fighting man. I think they were badly led. That's my opinion. It's only a personal opinion. It always seems